Hi, this is Jim Menick, and this is one of the series of podcasts that I like to refer to as The View from Tab. And today I want to talk about the postmodern condition. I want to actually give you an understanding of what postmodernism is without going into a lot of detail. This is actually easier said than done because well, postmodernism is so many things to so many different people. So what I'm going to try to do today is narrow it down enough so that if you are sitting around thinking about postmodernism, you'll actually be thinking about what some other people think is postmodernism rather than flailing around all on your own. For argument's sake, let's call this lecture The Postmodern Condition. This is the title of an essay by François Lyotard, and this has nothing to do with what Lyotard says. In other words, it's not a critique or a review or based on Lyotard. But the postmodern condition, the idea of the postmodern condition, is a really good way of understanding what we're going to talk about. For reasons that'll become clear later on, we're going to start talking about science. Now, science seeks the truth about the world around us. And how does it do this? Well, science and scientists test hypotheses. You observe an event, and from those observations, you postulate a hypothesis. And then you do different tests to see if that hypothesis will stand, and if, in fact, the tests prove the hypothesis, well, that is now accepted as fact. The hypothesis becomes fact. That's the way science works. You come up with an idea, you prove it. And once it's proven, it's proven. There's a famous book, well, I don't know how famous it is, but there's a famous line from Einstein about this book, and I think the book was 1,000 Scientists Prove Einstein Wrong, was the title of the book. It might have been 100 scientists prove Einstein wrong. I'm not quite sure which, and I'm too lazy to look it up. But anyhow, 1,000 scientists prove Einstein is wrong. And Einstein was alive when the book came out, and his response was very simple. It only takes one. That's the way science works. It only takes one, because science is based in fact. And if, in fact, a hypothesis or a thesis, call it what you will, a theory, is disproven, and it's disproven. You can't believe in it anymore if, in fact, it isn't, well, fact. And you know it's not fact because it doesn't stand up to the tests. Now, here's an important part of how this works, how science works. Each fact builds on the previous facts. In other words, we know this little bit, then we can go forward and add to it this next little bit and add more and more bits. Science is progressive. It builds on the previous facts. And this is a dialectic. This is a process of ever moving toward truth, or if there's such a thing, ever moving toward more truth. So we should define right away what a dialectic is, because that's going to be a very important concept to discuss when we talk about the postmodern condition. Now, the definition, the classic definition of a dialectic is that we have a thesis, one idea that conflicts, bounces against another idea called the antithesis, the antithesis. And when those two ideas hit, there is a resulting third or new idea, which is called the synthesis. And the process of the dialectic is the ever-continuing, progressive battle of thesis versus antithesis, and new synthesis, and new synthesis, and new synthesis, ultimately leading, if you believe Hegel, ultimately leading to complete, final, ultimate truth. Now, this concept of ideas meeting ideas. Now, Hegel is hard to read, and I'm not recommending that you run right out and read Hegel. but I will recommend that you run out right away if you haven't already done so and read John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, because he talks about the same process. And he talks about, for him, he's talking about it as a free speech situation, but that the truth ought to be tested. The truth requires testing. So he's saying that we have a received truth. We have something we believe is true, and we shouldn't be afraid to push that truth out into the world and bounce it against other ideas. When we bounce it against other ideas, a variety of things will happen. If we take our truth and bounce it against some other idea, and the other idea turns out to be true, we're better off for it, because we now have a new truth. If we put our idea out there and other ideas bounce up against it and they don't work, and our idea is the one that wins, then that's good too, because it proves that our truth wasn't just something we believed because, well, we believed it, but something that actually could stand a test. But most likely, according to Mill, and certainly most likely according to Hegel, is what's going to happen is we're going to put one idea out there and another that we think is true, and another idea is out there that someone else thinks is true or has some other, you know, value to it, and those two ideas are going to hit, and we're going to get more truth or better truth as a result of the mixing of the two ideas. So we're talking here a process of moving toward the truth or gaining more truth, or however you want to look at this. Now let's get back to science. Are there any exceptions in science to the rule of you have a hypothesis, you prove it, and we have fact? Is there any exception to this? Well, the answer, of course, is none. As I said, if somebody disproves something, well, it's disproven. That's it. So you can't go about believing in alternate science. You can't believe. You can't choose, for instance, not to believe in gravity. Okay, gravity is a observable, measurable force. You may not understand everything there is to know about it, but you can understand an awful lot of it, and you can't decide that it doesn't exist. You can't have alternate science. Science, the whole process of science, the dialectic process of science, the testing process of science does not allow for alternate science and disbelief in the products of proof. However, you can improve science. Take a look at Newtonian physics. Okay, Newton and his concept of gravity. All that Newtonian business was enough to get us to send the Apollo space missions to the moon. Okay, all of that science is based on that understanding of gravity, Newton, that sort of math. However, we certainly learned way many more new things about gravity thanks to the theory of relativity and Einstein. Newton saw none of this, but Newton's facts remain still proven when you're talking about, well, you know, big, massive objects. And what happens is when you throw in Einstein, you just get more truth, better truth. You understand even bigger objects or tinier objects, whatever the case may be, and those special aspects of gravity. You have a better understanding of gravity, a revised, shall we say, improved, moved towards more truth version of gravity. So Einstein doesn't come along and disprove what has already been proven. He adds on to what's already been proven. There's more facts, more knowledge, more truth. The dialectic movement of science begins with our first accurate understanding of the world around us. So go back to the cavemen, and they started, you know, having whatever reasons they believed, whatever they believed, and at some point they start testing things and learning something. They finally learned some facts. Certainly the Greeks proved a lot of things about physics and mathematics very early on, and the understanding of the world around us began to grow, and as each hypothesis was proposed and tested and proven over time, there was an ever-growing warehouse of facts building on to each other, more knowledge as time goes on. Now, we need to understand the mindset of the dialectic to understand the meaning of postmodernism. And science is, at least to me, the clearest example of the dialectic process. I mean, one of the reasons is because science actually does progress in a historical and even perhaps narrative fashion. And human beings, people, us, we like that. We like historical progress. We like that idea of historical progress. We like stories with a beginning and a middle, and presumably an end, but certainly a beginning and a middle, a development of the story. History, therefore, is, in our minds, progress. As time goes by, we have more and more movement toward the truth. So history becomes, in our minds, dialectical. But the problem is, it isn't. There isn't a dialectic of history. Just because something happened before, whatever is happening now, doesn't mean we have progress. And that's what leads to the postmodern condition. Postmodernism is in a lot of things. I mean, there's postmodernism in painting and architecture and music and writing and in philosophy. Other places, our interest, of course, is philosophy. But I always maintain that you need to know more than just the philosophical side of it to really understand it. Now, if you want to know a lot about postmodernism and a lot about the ideas of modernism and postmodernism and premodernism and all that sort of thing, I strongly recommend you listen to the caveman lectures that are on my website. But here, I just want to talk about what is that postmodern condition. And I want to make a note here, just a general note. We're not talking about things like the difference between the word postmodern and the word postmodernism, or the word modern versus modernistic versus modernism, or for that matter, to a great degree, as you'll find out, we're not even talking that much about postmodernism versus modernism, at least in things like painting or philosophy. We're trying to be understood. I want you to understand what I'm saying. I'm not trying to confuse you, and I'm not throwing out a lot of words, so I'm going to use words in the broadest context, not incorrect context, by the way. I'm not making up my own context, but I'm using the ones that make the most sense. Anyhow, let's switch away from science and look at painting. And you'll see why. Painting at the very beginning, going back to the cavemen. I always like to go back to the cavemen if I possibly can. Painting from the beginning is representational. There's a straight line from the cave paintings in Lascaux to Rembrandt, and things look more and more real as time goes by. Painters learn a lot of things. I mean, they learn perspective and color and light. They learn how to paint skin tones. I mean, skin tone isn't one thing. There's shades and colors on skin tones. They learn how to use canvases. You know, they used to paint on wood or walls or whatever. They learn how to use brushes. And as a result of all this learning, all this growth, all this, what I would say is definitely progress. If in fact, getting more realistic is progress, they do get more realistic. Stuff does look more and more real. You can see some paintings in the 16th, 17th century that are phenomenally realistic looking. And add to this that because of this realism and some other stuff, anyone who sees these works of art, anyone who looks at these works of art, can recognize their quality, can look at a Rembrandt and say, gee, that's a good painting. So, you know, yeah, maybe you can do more if you're really, you know, study painting or something like that. But even at the time, and certainly now, you look at these paintings and say, that's good. That is good. It's not hard to tell what's good because we have a standard of what's good, and the standard of what's good is realism. So if realism, realisticness, is a measure of what is good, and there are maybe other measures, but that's certainly a strong, important measure. If we have that measure, we can say that painting is good. So, as I say, the dialectic of Western painting might be that truth, the truth that we are seeking, is realism. That's the truth that we're seeking in a painting. Unfortunately, what happens is that around 1850s or so, photography is invented. And as a result, we now have an absolute perfect way of recreating reality. We have a perfect way of being realistic. I mean, from the very beginning, photographs are going to be more realistic, in the classic definition of the word realistic, than paintings are going to be. And in short order, as photography improves, becomes even more realistic, and you don't even have to understand too much about science and the improvement of photography as a painter to realize that photography is a true challenge to what you've been doing for the last couple of thousand years as a painter. Artists ultimately respond to the fact that the dialectic of approaching more and more realism doesn't work anymore by going into abstraction. And maybe we have to ask ourselves, is that the new dialectic for painting, the personal expression through abstraction? Or is it in fact the breakdown of any dialectic of painting? Abstraction is very personal. Each artist in their abstraction is looking at their own inner thinking in the way they abstract things. It's very personal, and the question may be, is the art is now just the question of seeking personal truth rather than objective realism, but some kind of personal realism, shall we say? And one of the questions you have to ask is, if art is no longer measurable by its measure of reality, in other words, if you look at a painting and in the olden days say, well, that really looks like Joe Blow, and now it looks like red splotches, how do you know anymore what's good art and what's bad art? Who gets to tell what's good art and bad art? I mean, if you can't do it, if the average person on the street can't do it, only educated people can do it. Some trained elite can do this, or only the artists themselves. These are tough questions. One of the answers to this question, if not the chief answer, or let's put it this way, the chief question that responds to these questions, may be seen in the toilet of Marcel Duchamp. I forget the year, I think it was in the 20s, but Duchamp essentially just took a toilet from a plumbing store or wherever and signed it and said, we're going to hang this in a museum. And by my signing it, that makes it a work of art. Art is what artists say art is. That's the statement that Duchamp is making. But in the real world, art is also what galleries say it is. You know, the people who sell art, people who buy art, don't they get to say what art is? Art in the real world would have to be what museums say it is. So Duchamp can say this is art because it's signed. Actually, signed it with a pseudonym, but it was signed nonetheless. Some museums refuse to hang it. So if a museum refuses to hang this thing that the artist says is art, is it still art? Or do museums get a vote in what art is? And even if you can accept what Duchamp says, he still raises the question, what is it that makes someone an artist in the first place? If art is what artists do, what makes someone an artist? Let's leave those hanging and skip to architecture for a second, because architecture, as it turns out, bestows our terminology on us. Architecture is big. Okay, a painting, or a toilet, or whatever, all of these things are relatively small. They're in a building somewhere. You have to go out of your way to seek them, and only a handful of people will do that, presumably. Whereas if I build a building in the middle of a city, it's big, it's unavoidable. Everybody walking by sees it. Millions of people will see it. Every time there's a photograph of the city, that building will be there. Because of this bigness of the building, it's just sort of coincidental. Architects themselves have big egos to go along with their big building. Some of them also have a lot of time on their hands because you don't build a lot of these big buildings. So a lot of architects have been theorists as well. Anyhow, in the 20th century, architects are building big and they're thinking big. And their thinking went way beyond just the buildings themselves. And they started thinking about cities. They became urbanists. They became urban planners. There's a famous architect, Le Corbusier, who is especially known as a modernist He essentially invented modernism, or at least he's the most famous inventor of modernism. And his idea was that the future city, the modern city, the end of city building for all practical purposes, is going to be a very plain, tall building on a very large lot. And on the rest of this lot, let's say this lot might be about 4 or 8 city blocks long, and one corner of the lot is a big, tall building, and the rest of the area has nothing on it. It's just landscaped. Maybe it's grass, or maybe it's concrete, or maybe it's statues, whatever it is. But, you know, the building, there's no other buildings. There's the big building and this empty landscape, and there'll be, these will be dotted along the landscape. His picture of Manhattan is literally these little areas blocked along, surrounded by, well, just like I say, these flat land areas. The buildings themselves are very plain and, as I say, tall. And one of the things that's important to remember is that architects are very much interested in form equaling function, or at least by this time, form equals function for an architect. So, I mean, the function of these buildings is to be a part of the modernist landscape as much as anything else, which, and to some extent, accounts for their plainness. You don't need decoration in a modern universe. You just need rooms to put stuff in. There's a perfectly good example of this, by the way, that was actually built, which is the UN building. Okay, you look at the UN building. It's a very tall, plain building, and it's on a very large, empty area. And Corbusier was one of the people involved in the design of this and the planning of that building. And if it had been up to Corbusier, we would have torn down the rest of New York and built it exactly the same. So you'd have a lot of buildings like the UN dotting the landscape. But, and this is a big but, this modernistic idea, this modernism movement was rife. I mean, people were very strong on this, very big on this, and you can see all kinds of examples of it in movies that were made at the time, and in all kinds of architectural drawings, and the buildings that are built, and in the writings that are written, and, you know, this is just the thing. But there's a big but, is that this modernism failed. This urban vision failed. People do not like science fiction type cities. People, real people, prefer the complex, organic communities that they already have. You know, in New York, when people tried to build things that would be like this, and the people in the community said, no, just don't do this. We like our communities the way it is. And in fact, we need our communities to be the way they are. So therefore, as a result of the fact that, you know, modernism didn't work, this urban vision didn't work, modernism, for all practical purposes, as a vision of the future, failed. And there was a bigger therefore. Anything that happens after modernism fails, anything that comes next after modernism, is called postmodernism. In architecture, postmodernism means a lot of things. It means that architects are freed from the boundaries of materials. I mean, once upon a time, if you were going to build, you're going to build rocks and you're going to build domes and all this sort of stuff that marks the cathedrals and so forth of Europe. Nowadays, you have new materials practically coming out every year. You can build out of, you know, anything you want. Architects are freed from the boundaries of mathematics. I mean, nowadays, we have all the, you know, computing power necessary to build any kind of complex structure that will, in fact, work, going back to Newtonian physics. I mean, gravity is still going to matter, forces are still going to matter, but we can figure them out in a much more complex manner than we used to be able to, you know, 300 or 400 years ago. We are freed from the boundary of purpose. After modernism fails, we don't have to build the modern city anymore. We don't have to think that what we're doing is a part of a modern landscape. Purpose can change. Purpose can be very malleable. There's no single-mindedness and modernistic purpose anymore. Remember, in the past, the biggest buildings were built by the church or by the state. Coming into the 20th century, buildings are often, if not almost exclusively, built by businesses. The best, biggest buildings are business buildings. Each purpose of a business is unique to that particular business, changes from business to business, from company to company. Architecture is freed from the boundaries of history, because history for architecture is over. We have had a progression of history, if progress is the right word. We certainly had a movement from the classic kind of architecture, the Greek and the Roman architecture. We had Gothic architecture. We had Baroque architecture, Rococo architecture. Then we had Neo this and Neo that, and right up to modernism. And you could look at this and say, maybe there's a story here. Maybe there's a progression here. But after modernism, the history is gone. There's no right way to build anymore, no style that has to be followed. Everything has changed. So the dialectic of architecture, and there was definitely a dialectic, a perceived progress toward truth, the dialectic of architecture ended when the vision of the future died. No more so-called progress was possible. We do not get better through history anymore, if in fact we ever did. Postmodern architecture is eclectic. It's whatever it wants to be. Sampling, shall we say, of styles is very big in the postmodernist bag of tricks, because it doesn't matter anymore. Because architecture is big, and its practitioners had big egos, have big egos. Architecture has a big effect. And the word postmodernism began to be applied to other areas, even when there was no modernism for it to follow. Art in general, is Jackson Pollock, for instance, is he modern or is he postmodern? Or does it matter? The point is that the dialectic from painting to Marcel Duchamp broke down. Okay, as soon as we learned that we were no longer seeking the ultimate realism, we had to come up with something else. And as a result, add to this, as I say, Marcel Duchamp saying that art is what artists say art is. Henceforth, all artists must confront the knowledge that art is what an artist says it is, which brings up that question of what makes you an artist. Also, that art is what some elite says it is, the critics and the galleries and the museums. So, right there you have a conflict, perhaps, of those two ideas. The eternal question ultimately becomes, who gets to say what art is? Because there is no dialectic. There is no progress anymore toward anything. All standards have broken down. The modern artist must always ask that eternal question, who gets to say what art is? And asking that question is the quintessence of the postmodern condition. So even though painting, for instance, doesn't really have a modernist phase, all artists today are captive to the postmodern condition. Who gets to say what art is? In philosophy, we have a similar breakdown of the dialectic. I mean, philosophy theoretically seeks truth. Theoretically, there's a straight line from the cavemen, my favorite people, to the rationalists. They grow through the understanding of knowledge. But starting in the 19th century, we begin to wonder about truth. I mean, obviously, the goal of seeking more knowledge is truth. We start wondering about truth. And one of the things we learn is that philosophy is unprovable. There's no testing of hypotheses, unlike science, to a degree much like painting after we have invented photography. We see that our philosophy is cultural, not inherent. Our thinking is culturally determined, not objective. The rationalists weren't some natural flowering of truth. They were merely the latest chronologically. the latest thinkers along a timeline, but history and chronology do not equal correctness. New ideas are not inherently superior, nor is it possible to test them. So maybe we are not getting closer to the truth in our philosophy. And look at this. Other cultures have totally different philosophies. Philosophy being, of course, culturally based. And as we get into a more modern world and we get to see more of what goes on in the world around us simply because of the ages of communication and transportation, you know, we just get to know more. We start to say, wait a second, these people, there's 2 billion of them, don't believe anything we believe in. We start to see that our cultural beliefs are often owned by a very small elite, the professors or the bishops or, well, the art critics. We learn what they tell us to learn. But why them? Why do they tell us? Why those particular people? The framing of the dialectic seems to depend on who's framing it, if there's any dialectic at all. Knowing about the power structure of knowledge, and knowing about the cultural chauvinism of knowledge, the honest philosopher concludes that the dialectic for finding truth is flawed, and no more truth can be proven if we haven't proven any truth in the past. Nietzsche is famous for saying that God is dead, but what he's really saying is philosophy is dead. The dialectic of philosophy has broken down. That is the dilemma of postmodern philosophy. And the postmodern philosopher must be like the postmodern artist. Philosophy is what philosophers say it is, but what makes you a philosopher? Philosophy is what some elite says it is, critics or universities or whatever. What justifies their inclusion into that elite? Those are the essential questions of postmodern philosophy. And always asking these questions, is the essence of the postmodern condition. Okay, so the postmodern condition is the knowledge that there are no universal answers. There is no objective, provable, scientifically testable knowledge to be found. So how do we tell good art from bad art? How do we tell good philosophy from bad philosophy? How do we tell true religion from untrue religion? In the past, we assumed that over time, through history, we got closer to the truth. But we realized that history is merely events in the past, not a process, not a movement toward truth. We are not on a dialectic path toward anything. That is the postmodern condition. Is this bleak? Is this a bleak vision of the world? First of all, remember, it's only an academic vision. And second of all, it really isn't that bleak. First of all, there is plenty of truth to be learned through science. And one of the things that's happening in modern science, I hesitate to say postmodern science, is that we're learning that a lot of things we used to think of as philosophy or psychology are now physiology. We're learning a lot of connections that we never saw before. We're learning a lot about humans that we never knew before. Provable things, true things. At the same time, one of the things that philosophy informs is our choices about right and wrong. And our beliefs in what is right and what is wrong still must motivate our actions. We live in the real world. We take real actions. And we still are responsible for morality in choosing which actions we take. Now we know more, by the way, about others, the others. We know more about other cultures. We know more about disenfranchised people within our own cultures. And maybe we have a little less blind belief in ourselves as a result. This is probably a good thing. But is there any truth at all to seek? Philosophical truth? Well, that would, of course, would be religion. And faith in religion has never, ever been undermined by its unprovability. The very definition of faith is the fact that it's unprovable. So faith in things that we don't know and can't see and so forth can't be shaken just because, well, it's this year versus that year. It's a postmodern philosophy versus a modern philosophy. Can't happen. In the postmodern condition, we choose to believe what we want to believe. The postmodern condition gives us license to do this, but none of the responsibilities of acting morally and seeking personal or objective truth will go away because of the postmodern condition. It's only the definition of truth that changes. The truth itself, whatever it is, remains the same.